Welcome to Goleie, where we shed some light on politics, policy and polling in Wales and the world. This episode of Goleie features a conversation between Professor Laura McAllister of the Wales Governance Centre and Paul Silk on the subject of Lord Ivor Richard of the Richard Commission and Sir Michael Wheeler Booth and their contribution to devolution and the development of the National Assembly for Wales.
Over recent weeks, both Paul and I have lost two very good colleagues and friends, two people that we've both worked with in different capacities and both of whom have made, I think, very significant contributions to Welsh politics and to the governance of Wales, namely Lord Richard, PC, QC, Ivor Richard, and Sir Michael Wheeler Booth, who people might not know very well, but both Michael and Ivor Richard have been really critical figures in the advancement of a stronger and more mature system of Welsh devolution.
I knew Michael much better than Ivor, who I've only met during the course of chairing the commission that I chaired. But Michael I've known since the 1970s, and his involvement in Welsh life, which I think is has been really important and really valuable for us in Wales. I don't think anybody who met him in the 1970s would ever have believed that he would become a figure of any consequence in Welsh life at all.
So I guess it's worth rehearsing what these two individuals did for Wales, really. I mean, Michael was someone who had been clerk to the Parliament in the House of Lords and had worked very closely at a Westminster level, but actually got involved with Welsh politics almost by accident, didn't he, originally?
Yes. Well, I think that the story is that when the standing orders were being drafted for the original assembly back in 1998, they looked to my old profession, the clerks in the House of Commons, for somebody who could help them from a professional point of view in doing it. And actually, there was nobody in the House of Commons who was prepared to volunteer for this this particularly difficult piece of work. So the then clerk of the House of Commons, I think, persuaded Michael, who had just retired as clerk of the Parliament, clerk of the House of Lords. And that accidental involvement in Welsh affairs, I think, became a theme from 1998 through until his death. And he carried on being involved and interested in Welsh affairs.
And he was quite emotionally connected, I think, after a while, wasn't he, with our small nation and governance here. And I think he was a bit shocked by what he saw, having been involved, obviously, with the drafting of the original standing orders, which, of course, had to be framed within a pretty flawed constitutional
yes.
model of devolution.
Yes.
You know, we're talking here, aren't we, of a model of limited executive powers with no separation between the executive and the legislature, weird situations like ministers sitting on on committees that scrutinised their portfolios and so on. He must have been quite horrified at what he saw.
I think he was absolutely horrified. And he wasn't the only one, I think. That commission was chaired by Gareth Wardell, who you remember was the Labour MP for the Gower. And I think Gareth shared Michael's horror of what this strange creature had been created. My own view was that it was created so that it was going to fail, but I'm told that wasn't actually Ron Davis's intention.
It's interesting that, though, isn't it? Because there's two ways of looking at that dreadfully flawed first model of devolution that we had that emanated from the Government of Wales Act 1998. And as you say, politically, you could draw the conclusion that it was designed to fail, or you could draw the alternative conclusion, which I know Ron Davis puts forward, which is he had to grab as much as he could in a short space of time from the model of devolution that was being put forward for Scotland, but with a much greater sense that this was going to be a harder sell in Wales. And of course, the hegemony of the Labour Party in Wales and the reluctance of a lot of Labour MPs to even countenance a devolution made it much more difficult for Ron. So I think it's probably somewhere in between the two things, isn't it?
Yeah.
But actually, devising standing orders for a flawed institution is probably much harder, isn't it, than doing it for an institution that is fit for purpose?
It probably was the case. I was that much younger and more junior then, so I wasn't part of this discussion. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if some of my former colleagues, senior colleagues in the House of Commons, thought, I'm not going to have anything to do with that institution. It just looks so odd. And Michael was persuaded to get stuck in. And as you said, he became really fascinated by by Wales. I mean, he liked Wales. I live, as you know, in the Usk Valley, and Michael used to come and visit the Usk Valley and fish in the Usk Valley. So he loved Wales for all sorts of reasons, as well as his politics. But I think he found his politics exasperating, as you know better than me.
Yeah. Well, we can come on to that, but it's worth reminding ourselves of what else he did for Wales and in Wales, because as well as the Standing Orders Commission, he then chaired the independent panel on financial support for AMs, which of course was quite critical in the light of what's happened subsequently with raising the pay of assembly members to percentages of the norm for elected politicians in other institutions. And there was quite a big hike, wasn't there, to get it up to, I think, around 80% of the pay of Westminster MPs. And then, of course, he sat on the Richard Commission as a member of that commission that met between 2002 and 2004. And, of course, I was a member of that commission, got to know Michael and Ivor, obviously, very, very well during that period. And for me personally, I struck up a very close friendship with Michael during that time. And we made a kind of strange companions in some regards, especially as the third person that we were very close to was Ted Rowlands, who, of course, was the former Labour MP for Merthyr Tydfil, now a member of the House of Lords. And actually, Ted and I probably came from relatively similar backgrounds, but Michael, of course, came from a very different background, different class, fundamentally, and different place, really. And he'd had such a fascinating career, really, as a kind of bon viveur and traveller, and had travelled all over the world seeing and meeting people, and had this real passion for people, which I've never really experienced it to such an extreme degree in anyone else that I've met in my lifetime. Mm. But I remember when we undertook some of the consultation around the Richard evidence, and we travelled all around Wales to Llandudno and Aberystwyth and West Wales, and I can't remember all the locations now, but Michael and Ted and I would often go out for a drink. And we'd sit in some scruffy pub in some town, and we'd have really in-depth conversations about Welsh politics. And it was probably the most fascinating conversations I've had, really, with individuals, because they came at it from such a different perspective. Mm-hmm. But the thing I remember most about Michael's contribution was that he had this just kind of very simple way of saying, why don't you just get on with it? You know, he had this real belief that we could do things better and more straightforwardly in Wales if we had a bit more confidence and belief in what we're all about.
And that's the perspective of an outsider sometimes, isn't it? And there have been other, yes, Jerry Holtham's work where they brought in an Austrian academic, and I think that really strengthened that work. All three of the members of Jerry Holtham's commission were in their own ways external to Wales. But I think Michael did that, and I think perhaps Ivor Richard too. Although, as you've written, was of course very much a Welshman.
Yes,
he had a lot of external perspective as well.
He did, and it's very rare, isn't it, that somebody emerges like Ivor Richard. You know, he was born in Cardiff, but his family moved very early on to Betws, near Ammanford, in the industrial bit of Carmarthenshire. I know just how passionate he felt about being Welsh, even though he'd left at a fairly young age to go to school and then to university in Oxford. And then his career had taken him to the European Commission, to the United Nations. And of course, he was elected as an MP in Barons Court in London. So he'd been a minister, a backbencher, a diplomat. And of course, he was a barrister by profession. But I remember Ivor talking very passionately about Wales and the Welsh people, and interestingly, at his funeral a few weeks ago, there was a male voice choir singing in the chapel in West Norwood in South London, and there was a real sense of Welshness about the affair, and I think that really captured Ivor's passion for Wales. And I remember when he was appointed, because I don't think he was the first choice of the First Minister at the time to chair the commission on or the Secretary of State, because of course it was a UK government commission as well, you know, in terms of liaison. Ivor wasn't the first choice, but I think it was very, very opportune that he did chair the Richard Commission, because he brought a huge amount of gravitas and a huge amount of distance to the debate about Welsh devolution. He took some of the sting out of it, But nevertheless, you could tell he was very, very determined that what we recommended as a commission would see a workable model of devolution come into play, which clearly we didn't have at that point.
He absolutely was an authoritative figure that we needed in Wales at that time to authoritative and also not in the weeds of the debate. So he was outside it, but authoritative. And yes. I think that just looking at this as an outsider, somebody who read the Richard Commission, was interested in the Richard Commission report, the fact that it was chaired by him, and of course included all the diverse people that were inside the commission, who had a very interesting set of members as well as both Michael and Ivor.
Absolutely, but I guess that brings challenges as well.
Yes,
doesn't it?
Yes.
You've got people who are members of the political parties or have been asked to serve by the political parties. Then you've got people like Michael and people who are independent and probably not experts on governance, but bring something from civic society. And it was quite a large commission in that respect, a hybrid sort of model of recruitment. But that takes a good chair, doesn't it?
And I think you were unanimous, except on one thing where Ted was exactly. A dissenting voice, which was remarkable.
It was, and that was, if you remember, was about the need to hold a referendum on the alternative model of the, and that came very late in the deliberations from Ted. And I still say to him jokingly, I think he just had cold feet right at the end in terms of recommending the unanimous report that we came out with. But I have to say, Ivor was an incredibly skillful chair as well. He managed to bring people with him through a kind of combination of very gentle persuasion and respect for everybody's viewpoints. And he didn't treat people who were maybe less academically immersed or practically immersed in the subject any differently to those people who had had years and years of experience of working in the field. He was very consensual. He was very egalitarian, I think, and he was a very kind person. He had a great regard for how people were experiencing what was a quite intense piece of work, really.
Actually, when you mentioned those qualities, they were shared absolutely by Michael, weren't they? Kindness, egalitarianism were two of the characteristics I'd identify with Michael.
And the other thing, which I think where there are real similarities, I mean, clearly, as you mentioned, they were both outsiders. Ivor was only an outsider by having moved out of Wales, whereas Michael was an Englishman. But both of them could see the potential of Wales as well and found it disappointing that we were so timid, really, as a nation in terms of our ambitions for politics. They found it really peculiar. And don't forget, Ivor, of course, was a lifelong member of the Labour Party and had represented the Labour Party in terms of his own elections. But both of them found it odd that there was not more plurality of politics in Wales, and electoral politics and party politics. And they both felt that had probably held us back in terms of our ambitions and thinking. Yeah.
Well, I certainly know when I chaired the commission I chaired and showed the reports to Michael, he upbraided me for their timidity. And that was very much what Michael would do in a gentle and supportive way, and I think I thought to myself when I was doing this, well, what will Michael think about what we're recommending? There are a few others like yourself, Laura. I might have thought, what will she think about it too? But I certainly Michael was in my frame of thought.
That's a kind of verdict on somebody's importance, isn't it? Because I found myself doing that a lot of the time when I wrote about devolution after the Richard Commission, and sometimes I would run articles and papers past Michael or Ivor, and I'd always get from Ivor I'd always get a seal of approval, but from Michael I'd get a very spidery handwritten note, usually written diagonally across a page with incredibly intricate detail to add or to support a point I was making. And if he felt that the claims were not robust enough or ambitious enough, he'd be the first person to tell you. And I think being able to say mentally, I wonder what Michael or Ivor or indeed yourself would think about these things is a really important verdict on their importance in terms of public service. And by the way, Ivor, I mean, I've got lots of memories of Ivor as a chair of the Richard Commission, but I think the one that stands out for me is how he had no truck for anybody who gave evidence to us who told us that things couldn't happen because of politics and party politics in Wales. And in fact, I won't name names here, but I remember either standing up to some quite senior people, both at UK ministerial level and at Welsh Government ministerial level, when Richard Commissioners would suggest scenarios for change, and we were told that that just couldn't happen because of politics. And I remember one withering put down from Ivor where he reminded some of the witnesses that we were interested in a system of devolution that would work for the people of Wales, not for any party in Wales. And this was coming from a man from the dominant party. He had no fear about saying that to one of his colleagues, and in fact insisted that was the tone of all of our deliberations.
Because of where he came from, he couldn't be put down and dismissed by that, whoever this person was, because, exactly. You know, not many people have sat around the European Commission table, not many have sat around the Security Council of the United Nations and the UK Cabinet Committee. Right, not very many people have done that.
Absolutely. Global, supranational roles, as well as very, very local ones. No, absolutely. I think what Ivor did very well was take his experience of being a challenge or a thorn in the side of reform, people who'd objected to reform elsewhere, and he brought it into the devolution debate. Because, again, at his funeral, the minister officiating was his good friend, Reverend Leslie Griffiths, who, of course, was a fellow Lord with Ivor. And he talked a lot about Ivor having been against the grain of popular opinion on a few important things, like Britain's membership of the European Union. He talked a lot in his speeches in the House of Lords about how out of sync British attitudes were to Europe, and how discourteous a lot of that was in his eyes. And of course, he was very much in favour of reform of the House of Lords, to create an elected House of Lords, which is why he was sacked, of course, by Tony Blair whilst he was Labour leader of the Lords. And again, on devolution, you know, Ivor was a passionate supporter of devolution at a time when not many other senior people in his party were prepared to do that. But as Leslie Griffiths said in the eulogy to Ivor at the funeral, this wasn't because he was an awkward character. It was because he'd believed in something, because he'd read and thought about it, and he wouldn't be budged from that by somebody who'd come in with just purely partisan views.
And, of course, Michael was involved himself in the reform of the House of Lords in several manifestations, and that was something which, again, outside Wales, he did a lot to advance. The other thing I'd say about Michael, and you'll know this, he was really interested in young people and in communicating with young people and teaching young people, because when he left the House of Lords, he didn't retire. He became a lecturer in Magdalen College in Oxford. Yes, yes. And I had a communication just the other day from one of the brightest young people who works in the House of Commons. And she said, well, I came to work in the House of Commons because I went to Michael's seminars and I liked what I saw and I wanted to do the same job. So he really inspired people.
Exactly. And there was just something very unique about Michael, in the sense that he treated everyone very, very equally. For somebody who had great status and experience and could have limited his horizons to groups of people who were also of the same background as himself, I think he was fascinated with people generally. And I'm sure that made him an extremely good teacher. But he had time for people. You know, I experienced some of that myself, obviously, when he helped me with various projects that I was working on. But he would talk to some of my PhD students, and they would often get involved in a correspondence on a topic, and he'd give them the same attention as he would have a government minister, for example. And not many people really live up to that. A lot of people talk about doing that, but they don't actually walk the walk on it, whereas Michael did. And I have to say, in terms of Ivor's commitment to what he'd produced in the Richard report, I think I told you earlier, he'd send a Christmas card every year, and I think he'd probably send a card to every Richard Commissioner, but every Christmas I'd have a card from Ivor which said, we're edging closer. And as recently as last Christmas, in fact, you know, when he'd heard about our expert panel report on the size of the Assembly. And so he was obviously watching very closely what had happened to devolution since 2004. And I think, you know, whilst he was probably frustrated at the pace of change, I think he felt that the softly approach was gradually getting us to an institution that we could be proud of.
Yes, well, I think both of them probably had the one more drip wears away the stone philosophy.
Absolutely. But isn't it fascinating that so few people, even within the small group of us who are immersed in Welsh politics, would really know much about either of these two giants, in my opinion?
I suppose the Richard Commission, you know, that term in our small world is well known, but how many people actually knew Ivar and knew what his contribution was? And this is why it's very important for this sort of exercise to make people aware of it. But Michael would be completely unknown, I suspect, to people, other than those who've had the pleasure and privilege of being in his company. Which you, actually, anybody, once they've done that, won't forget it in a hurry.
But, you know, as I said in my Western Mail column, I think it's important that people do know how significant a contribution Ivar and Michael made to Welsh politics, because I doubt if they would have been too bothered about not being celebrated and not being well-known amongst the Welsh population. But what they did care about was that we moved to a more effective system of devolution and a parliament that would actually deliver for the people of Wales. And in that sense, they were really men of the people. It's very rare, you know, it's often used as an expression, but it's very rarely true in my experience when that term is applied. Mm-hmm. But in both of these cases, you know, they were people who put the public first, and they tried to see how constitutional matters impacted on ordinary people. And there's not that many people who work in that terrain, I think. Mm.
Both were exemplary public servants. And I think we sometimes don't recognise how much is done by people, both on the official side, as Michael was, and on the political side, in devoting time, energy, intellectual energy, to things for which they often get brickbats, and not always the recognition they deserve.
No, quite. And it's very easy, isn't it, to criticise public servants and to suggest that everyone who takes public office is after some aggrandisement or personal gain. But, you know, that, from my experience, it's usually the opposite of that. Mm. You have these towering intellects and people who put their backs into projects and actually get nothing from it, and probably has cost them quite a lot in terms of their own careers and time and families and so on. And I think we need to rehearse that more clearly, because public service is such a vital part of any thriving democracy, and we belittle it at our peril, don't we? And I fear for us in Wales, because we are in an environment where we assume that everybody is in public service for the wrong reasons, you know, a line in their pockets and so on. And my experience couldn't be further from the truth in that regard. There are a few bad apples, but by and large, most people are in it for the right reasons and actually sacrifice quite a lot to take charge of those roles.
I agree entirely with that, and that's not, I don't think that is particularly unique to us in Wales. I think throughout the UK, people have this very low respect for public servants, either elected or non-elected, and there are one or two elected people who deserve that low respect, but not many.
It's interesting, isn't it? I suppose we're approaching a big time of change in devolution now, with the powers from the most recent Wales Act coming on stream around new taxes, and then in a year's time, obviously, we have the potential for varying income tax. And when you look back to the Richard Commission, which of course reported 14 years ago, 15 years by the time income tax powers come on stream, we've had your two reports, Paul, two Silk reports. We've had a whole range of other smaller projects which have looked
well,
at different aspects.
Well, your expert panel as well.
Our expert panel.
Well, you chaired it.
You were a member of that too. But it's fascinating, isn't it? Because we've been overloaded with commissions and inquiries in Wales, but I get a sense now that we are getting there, do you?
Sometimes people say to you, well, what was the point of doing all that? They haven't implemented all your recommendations. Well, it takes time.
Yeah.
And the proof of the Richard Commission is that those recommendations are getting there, as Ivor said to you. We're getting there.
Absolutely.
Bit by bit.
Yes.
And the idea that somebody in Whitehall is going to get one of these documents landing on their desk and say, my God, they got it all right, and let's enact it all immediately.
Yes, yeah.
Well, that's not going to happen. But if you are persuasive enough in your argument, rigorous enough in the way in which you approach the issues that you're considering, and well-founded enough in your conclusions, then eventually it will happen.
Yes, and isn't it interesting how much continuity there is really in all of the big reports that have come out, you know, big in numerical terms, in terms of Silk and, of course, our recent expert panel. But if you look back at Richard, there's a lot that Richard set out that was then developed in your commission reports, Paul, and then that we took forward as well in terms of the expert panel about the size of the assembly and appropriate numbers to scrutinise effectively and about the value of scrutiny. I mean, you used the quote, didn't you, that good scrutiny will pay for itself. And we took that forward really with our expert panel, and I think we're winning the arguments. I mean, I'm an optimist by nature, but I do think we're winning the arguments. And actually, the public, my feeling is that the public might have been sceptical about devolution at the outset, but now we have it, they want a system that works for them. And if you compare what we have in Wales with other nations, especially Scotland, because, you know, the Welsh people can see a kind of congruence there, they find it odd that we don't have a fit-for-purpose assembly in the way that the Scots have for their parliament. And I do sense that we've kind of won that argument now, notwithstanding the issues about cost of more politicians and so on. But I think if that goes all the way back to the Richard report, which gathered the evidence for allowing us to then piggyback with updating and more contemporary sources.
It's interesting to go back to the stage of, you know, we were talking at the very beginning of this discussion about what Ron Davis intended at the beginning. And I wonder, we should do a podcast with Ron Davis and find out whether he would ever have predicted that we would be in this place that we are now. Then I rather think he might have, you know.
Yeah,
I rather think he might have expected the sorts of that he got what he could get from Tony Blair. But I think he would have seen the structural weaknesses in the model.
Yes. And the process, not an event, quote.
Yes.
Which is, you know, overused now, of course, does suggest that this was seen as a stepping stone to a model that would work.
The one thing I did discover was that process, not an event, was first used to describe the Cuban Revolution.
Was it really?
Yes. So
you can't claim official.
So it shows what Ron was reading.
Absolutely. Well, my thinking about the role of the Richard Commission is that it's easier to add flesh to the bones once an institution is up and running than it is to plan an institution before there is anything democratically elected there. Because if you look back at all the Parliament for Wales campaigns and even the campaign for a Welsh Assembly, which was cross-party prior in the 1990s, and then you look at the National Assembly Advisory Group, which was again was, you know, involving, it was kind of Canterbury Tales approach, wasn't it, bringing everybody to the table. But it's very hard to do that, isn't it, when there isn't, you know, any substance to an institution. I think when we look back at what Richard did, it was a really early intervention on a patently flawed model. So it could kind of unpick where the problems were, you know, as I think we did in the report quite extensively. But we didn't get bogged down with that. We used it as a springboard to look at a model that could work. And I think that's why it was so critical, really. It kind of spanned the critique of the model that didn't work with a vision of something that could work in the future. Would there be a will to implement it?
I think that's very important, that there was a vision in the Richard Commission. When we're talking about how far does this go back, I mean, Lloyd George, you know, you can go back an awfully long way and see the seeds of where we are now. and you know, had the First World War not come along, we might have had a parliament in Wales much earlier.
Yes, yeah.
But the steps, the bigger steps, are made when there's vision. It isn't just a mechanical exercise. It's got to be a visionary work. And I think having people like Ivor, yourself, and Michael involved in the Richard Commission did mean that that vision was there.
And underpinning that as well was a kind of conviction that Wales deserve better. Mm. And that is political. I mean, let's not take anything away from that. But, you know, it was interesting that lots of us, I'm not sure everyone, but lots of us on the commission did have that conviction that, you know, we weren't a lesser nation to anyone else in the UK, never mind in the world, and that why should we have such a poorly constructed model of devolution? But personally, I will say that it helped having people of the stature of Michael and Ivor articulating that. And for that reason, and lots of others, I think Wales owes an enormous debt of gratitude to Sir Michael Wheeler-Booth and Ivor Richard, because they gave us the confidence, really, to think bigger and better about what our democracy should look like.
Thanks for listening to Goli, a Cardiff University podcast. Subscribe in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from to have the next episode download automatically.